We are actually implementing the Gauss constraints. And so we are only left with the flatness constraints. And these are, I mean, the flatness constraints impose the dynamics. And so usually these are the more complicated ones. And in fact, we actually discuss 3D gravity because it's one case where one can actually solve them. But there is one other technical complication, which is that for the Gauss constraint, we didn't need it to define another inner product. And so I'm going first to discuss how to define a physical inner product for these cases like the flatness constraint. And so if you remember back when we were busy discussing the parameterized particle, actually we were not using that, but for the Gauss constraint, we did use a group averaging in action, an averaging over the orbits as a method to implement the constraint. So morally, we basically had this as projector onto constraints. And in the Gauss constraint case, it was really a projector. because it really satisfies p squared equal to p, which also means actually that p is really a proper operator in this case, in the sense that the resulting functions you get are still normalizable in your kinematical inner product. and so for this reason, you actually don't need to define a different inner product. And the reason that one gets this finiteness is due to having compact gauge orbits. And so this operator is defined by integrating over the gauge orbits. And so these are compact. So even if you average a function constant over the gauge orbits, you get just one or some other constant, which is finite. however, the flatness constraints will have actually non-compact gauge orbits. And again, that follows from the discussions we had at some point discussing what they do. And the action they lead to is this translation of the fluxes. So you add stuff to the fluxes, and for this reason it's called translation symmetry, which is a bit confusing. But this means that the orbits are something like R3 in our case. And so also for the parameterized particle, I mean, R3 times all kinds of R3 parameter space. For the parameterized particle, we also have a non-compact orbit, which we discussed. I forgot when we discussed it at some point. Because here the gauge symmetries include time translations and time reparametrizations, and time translations are indeed giving you a non-compact gauge orbit, basically R, an integration over R. And so here you would have the problem that basically, of course, you can find you can in principle define p squared. But basically, as we discussed, p squared is actually infinity. And so very mathematically unsatisfyingly ignoring lots of rules, what you basically get is an infinity in front of this equation. And so you have to somehow get rid of this infinity again. And so how does one do that? So the idea is here, if one has p squared, p, usually one hopes is also symmetric or at least or even self-adjoint. That's self-adjoint. And if this is the case, or if it's just symmetric, in case you have really a proper projector, you can use that P is symmetric, divide it on the other side, and you get a P squared, which is equal to P. Fine. So in fact, for these cases that you really have a proper projector, taking just one of the two entries in the inner product to be applied to with a p gives you the same result as having here the two p's. And so these would be actually kind of physical states. Physical states. And so actually that is taken as a motivation to define a physical inner product by saying if I want to have a physical product, which morally basically I get by applying this funny, so this would be P delta function in C. So we define this physical inner product between these two physical wave functions, which are defined to be to come from projections from the kinematical Hilbert space. To be given, there's some preference apparently, just by taking basically one of these delta functions into account. And taking the kinematical inner product here. So that has the advantage that you don't need to further think about what is actually the physical inner product. Because you have a formula for that. And of course, it's always basically the question in view of discussing the parameterized particle and these issues with frozen time, what is actually the interpretation of this procedure? So in the case of the parameterized particle, we could easily define an alternative kinematical product by omitting integration over time. But in this case, we had a good time variable. In the case of 3D gravity, we won't have a good time observable. So all the variables are either given by group elements or by spins. So you wouldn't know what to choose as a time observable. So that's why this general formula is helpful. And now let's look at the possible interpretation of these basically of this inner product. And typically what is called these are basically transition functions. transition elements between these wave functions. However, that is a kind of not very careful description of what is going on. So let's go back. You have to remember what is a parameterized particle, and let's go back to that and look at what happens in this case. So to remind you, in the parameterized particle, we basically had T as variables and Q as variables, and the constraint would be PT, the momentum conjugated to Q, plus the usual Hamiltonian, which is just a function of PQ and PT. No, PQ and Q. And so we could do basically the same. We haven't done it in this discussion of this parameterized particle in solving, because we just solved for physical states. But we actually could apply kind of group averaging also. So this constant is kind of a convention. And now I apply group, I define this delta function C as integral over the group action, over the gauge group action generated by this constraint. And so this is, as you know, if you have a momentum P, then the exponential IP of this operator generates an action corresponding to this momentum. So here I basically take the exponential of my constraint, and that's why I actually have an h bar here, because it appears here in this averaging. So it's again just kind of a convention. If you really want to see that as time evolution. Okay. So we have this result. We have this expression, and we need to figure out what is the action of this part on this wave function. And so I do a little trick. And we will see later why I do this trick, which is to introduce another parameter for the time, which is auxiliary, and actually rewrite this function as basically let me check. As the integral over R of F RQ times the delta function. And so you will see why I'm doing this. It basically tells us that here you have basically, you can see these as initial values at time R. And actually this function, you should see as a superposition of lots of these initial values, however, for different times. Okay, and then I have ds. Now the reason why I'm doing this is that you should remember how there's a simple part in this Hamiltonian or in this constraint. The other thing you should remember, so pt completely commutes with this Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian does not depend on time. So therefore, we can just split this exponential into the product of two of these two exponentials. And so then exponential SPT would not see anything of this. It does not depend on any time variable anymore. It only acts on this part. And so what does this part do? Not exactly, but you can evaluate it in Fourier transform. So this is momentum x as a generator of translations. If I write you that, I would, I can, okay. So this is a q plus s, and how do you prove that? You write explicitly the delta function, and you write all these things. And then you write more i's, which I usually forget, I, h bar, and probably there's a minus, n, d, d, kind of, dq n, that's obviously, that's the action of pn. Apply to fq, so here you get the, n's derivative of q. And probably that's why I have an h bar there to cancel actually this h bar. And the minus ones cancel. So what I get is a Fourier, is a Taylor series. Of fq plus s around fq. So what I do get is just a translation in this argument, delta in the delta function. Let's write this. So I'm left with just the Hamiltonian acting on this wave function with argument r and the delta function t plus s minus r dr ds. And so now I can solve for something. And I'm going to solve for s, this delta function. And so I get, yeah, just this thing running out of space. S has to be equal to r minus t. Or t minus r minus. And so actually now, this is interpretation. So we had this, that we had that at some point. that if you have a function which a wave function at a fixed t0, so these are the initial values, then you can from these initial values at a fixed t0 compute the physical solution. And that's the formula for the physical solution. So that's the solution of the initial value problem. And so what you see here is, in fact, that you take for each r, you take these f, r, q as initial values, and you compute the solution to the Schrödinger equation. And so what you get, Schrödinger equation is linear, so that's just the superposition that gives you another solution, it's just that it's written in a weird way. And of course, there are many equivalent ways to write it because this is in a projection. So many things, you know, will project either to zero or will project to the same wave function. but you see that the interpretation of applying this kind of averaging operator is you get basically, you get a physical solution, but with initial values which are spread over time. And that's actually quite nice in general because you could say, okay, this infinite thin time anyway interpretation is maybe a bit unphysical. And so you could allow for basically something which is peaked on a, in a Gaussian or around a Gaussian function in time. So in fact, kind of, if you want to keep this interpretation of a sharp initial value problem, you would actually choose your initial kinematical state. So this is really the kinematical state in being almost orthogonal to a physical state. be actually of this form with the delta function. And in fact, in a sense, you can also take this solution and rewrite it as an initial value function, as an initial value problem for a fixed time. So you can all, so basically what I want to say is that for any physical state, you find a kinematical state of this form. Actually, for arbitrary time t, which gives you this physical state. And of course, you can choose, you know, arbitrary time, it just means that you can always evolve from one state to from one time to another time. Okay. But naturally, you wouldn't actually guess. So these are extremely special states, of course, in the kinematical Hilbert space. I mean, they are not even in the kinematical Hilbert space. Because they are not integrable in time, clearly. So it's not what you would naturally choose. And so now we can basically consider these funny physical inner product defined on two wave functions, on two physical wave functions, which we say it is just phi 2 applied with one of these delta c, phi 1, the kinematical inner product. So basically, I just need to take the result there. And integrate it with some other function. And I have a slight mistake here, so let's fight psi 2 complex conjugated integrated over minus e. The time evolution of the state. And so we have dr dt DT is a kinematical inner product, and DQ is also the kinematical inner product. So this comes from the kinematical inner product. So if you now choose really these very special states, which mathematically you shouldn't, but you can do lots of undefined things here. And in this case, they cancel each other, luckily. So you basically choose both states of the special form. Be in a delta function in to be with peaked with delta functions in time at two different times, R1 and R2. And you put it in the solution here. And so these delta functions, they will, of course, allow you to solve for R here and T. And so what you are left with is just this thing which we just actually call transition amplitudes. So in this case, you get really transition amplitudes because it's taken psi 2, which is living actually at R2, and you evolve it from R1 to R2. I don't know why I have this here. There was a H. Had. So this last line is a standard interpretation of transition amplitudes between two times. Which you, however, get only for these wave functions peaked sharply in time. And these wave functions are not even in the kinematical Hilbert space. And so for more general wave functions, you basically get a superposition of this interpretation. So that means that you kind of have a complicated superposition problem in time for the initial values, and you take basically lots of these inner products. And that's what is written here. So basically, dr, d2 are basically these two slight averagings in these initial values. OK. So the nice thing is that we can apply this formula to quantum gravity. Not this formula exactly, but this idea of defining the physical inner product. As, yeah, basically in this way, which I'm going, as applying it only to one entry of your kinematical inner product. But what we now have to define is actually what is exactly this delta C. And actually, we actually always have written it as a in the form of a group averaging. But we can really understand it also as a delta function. And so we actually have the flatness constraints. we need to discuss the flatness constraints. And the flatness constraints were basically that the curvature is zero, and the curvature was this two form. And so it would be something in forms. It was something like a functional in A. so it's, again, just taking this expression of the curvature in the connection. We can't do that because we don't have the connection available. We only have holonomies. So what we need to find is kind of a quantization of F in terms of holonomies. And in this case, we can basically we'll have lots of Fs, which will be labeled by little Fs. And actually, we really can take directly something like the delta function in these operators nicely, as we will see. But basically, what we have to discuss is basically curvature in terms of holonomies. So what could this be? Any guesses? So the holonomies were there to do something, to parallel transport. And so you can take a vector and parallel transport it around a closed curve. And then you get another vector at the same point. And typically that's what we actually call curvature. So, and the curvature is associated to basically to this area. And in fact, the curvature is a two form. So fact for abelian series, meaning have an abelian group. You have the Stokes theorem. Which is known from differential forms. And in this case, this is a one form, and for an abelian series, F would be just dA, because for a B in series, this term would be just zero. So here you apply Stokes' theorem, and this gives you the curvature, which is a two form, which you can integrate over the two surface. And here I used already a bit of form language, which is every time I write a form, so this integral means the thing where I contract with the tangent vector of gamma, the one form index, and integrate over ds. And if one is lazy, one uses this form index to not write all these things out explicitly. And this is the two form. So here, this would be something anti-symmetric. So that actually goes well with the two form integration here, dx dy, if you call this two dimensional coordinates xy. So here we actually just applied Stokes' theorem, which I hope you have seen at some point, which for any form and any dimension means that you can shift these from the region you integrate over to the integrand. And it's a kind of generalization of the integral formula, actually, the integration formula. So that's kind of standard theorem in differential forms. And a Abelian theory is as good as having basically usual differential forms. However, in the non-Abelian theory, we have this extra term. And so that actually holds also a non-Abelian Stokes theorem for arbitrary surfaces, which I'm not going to prove. So basically, we will motivate a Stokes theorem, a kind of Stokes theorem for infinitesimal surfaces where infinitesimal, again, you have to take always with a grain of salt. Actually, that means, in principle, it means just kind of low curvature density in a sense. And non-Abelian groups. And so the aim is here we have the, of course, here we have the holonomy. Here we have the curvature. This is the exponential minus the integral over the curvature. If this term is small, we can just expand it. So we get that the holonomy is equal to 1 minus the curvature. And so, in fact, we can just take a closed holonomy. So I haven't mentioned that gamma here is a closed curve. So holonomy around a closed curvature as giving us curvature. The holonomy around a closed curve as giving us curvature modulo this identity matrix, which we have to subtract. And so once we have proven that, we know that we can take holonomies for curvature. OK, and so I will use that for infinitesimal curves and surfaces. So we will actually have a curve which will be still parametrized by 0 and 1. But in some auxiliary matrix, this curve is supposed to have length epsilon. And it's a closed curve. And so here is another place where we need the formula for our holonomy, which we had some lectures ago. And that was this parallel transport, the path ordered exponential. And basically, I'm writing the first few orders of this path ordered exponential. And I only need to go up to second order because the higher orders are at least epsilon to the third power. And here I again introduce too many different notations, so I needed to introduce that because to not notify here this ordering thing. That doesn't really matter. And so this means that you take the component, so this is the matrix valued and contracted with the tangent vector of gamma. Okay. And so this first, for the first term, so we want to reach that this is equal to the curvature. For the first term, we can just apply what we actually did for the B in theory. So it's matrix valued, but for every component of this matrix, you basically can apply Stokes' theorem. And so this will be equal to the surface, to the integral over the surface. Over the differential, over the exterior differential of A. And then we have the second term. Let me move here. And so this needs, this is a term which doesn't, which is much easier to treat in the B in theory, because in this case you can just commute all these things. And here one needs to massage this thing a bit. And actually what one does, and there are these factors of 1/2, is to rewrite that into a symmetric and antisymmetric combination. So I only add and subtract terms. But the advantage is of having, if I have the symmetric combination, this gives me, how did I go? As the symmetric contribution, this gives me the antisymmetric contribution. And so the symmetric contribution, I have now the advantage that the order doesn't matter because I symmetrized. And so in fact, I can treat these things as two independent. If I put these things together, I can treat this as two independent integrals. Hey, are you checking on me? He's looking for the colloquium. And it's equal to the square of 1a integrated over 0, 1. And so this is equal, as we have said here, this is equal to the integral over the surface. The surface is of order epsilon square. So this is a square of order epsilon square. So this is of order epsilon to the 4. And so we can ignore this term. And actually, the other term, the antisymmetric term, again, we have to basically argue at small epsilon. And so one brutally approximates it. By the values of the one form of the connection at one point in the integral. And that happened, I mean, you can take any point. So we take 0 here. It's an approximation. And what you are left is the stuff you would have contracted with your connection. So these are the tangent vectors. And so here you already have some kind of antisymmetric combination between between these vectors at two different times at S2 and S1. And one can further massage that. Let me do that. And basically, in the end, you just find the integral over the 2 surface. So here you integrate over one of these S's. And in coordinates of the surface, this is this antisymmetric contribution, which you can understand well now. Apply again Stokes' theorem and taking the differential of this result. And finally, one finds that the differential of this thing gives you just the integration measure of this coordinate 2 form over the surface. And so it has been a long computation, but basically here we said, oh, I approximate the integral by taking out one value of this function. So now one does the same thing actually backwards. And having these components gives you the wedge product between these two connections. And so one finds there's lots of these approximations that this is the wedge product of A wedge A of between these two matrix value things. And now we basically are finished. We wanted to evaluate these terms, so we get 1 minus this term. The symmetric part was 0. The antisymmetric part gives me this term. So H gamma is 1 minus S gamma dA plus minus S gamma A which A plus all the terms I neglected. And so, in fact, this, I write it, this is exactly 1 minus integral over the curvature, because that's how one defines the curvature in this differential form language. So you can do everything if you're not used to these differential forms. You can write everything out in coordinates. It just means that one has to write more things, and you will get the same result. and the only thing is, of course, one needs to be careful because different sources might have different conventions, but there's some conventions fixed in the script. Because before we had, if you remember, we had a curvature which was written dA, so dA comes from here, and that was antisymmetrized. So this is this differential part plus epsilon 2a's. And in fact, this wedge product is antisymmetric. So actually, if you write it out, you get the commutator of A, of two A's, and the commutator, I mean, the A's are Lie algebra valued. So this commutator term gives you the epsilon. So it's exactly the same, just that there are lots of constants, which of course have to work out. Okay. So actually, now we actually managed to quantize the constraint in the sense that we know what the curvature is. In terms of the holonomies, and what we know how to represent is functions of holonomies. So that's what the exercise was about. So basically, f hat will be something like holonomy around a closed curve gamma. And of course, the constraint is now that this gamma needs to be not equal to 0, but equal to 1. Because that's what means that f is 0, because the h gamma is 1 minus f. And so if I want to write, like, delta function flatness constraint, now what we can represent is functions of the holonomies, ignoring that the delta function is not a function despite its name. We can basically write the group delta function, which I asked you to play around with at some point. So this is a group delta function h gamma, and the group delta function morally gives you only a non-vanishing infinity contribution if h gamma is equal to 1. So something like that put in front of your wave function gives you a solution of the constraints. Of course, it's completely undefined because the delta function is something which is clearly, not clearly, but it's non-integrable over the group. It's not L2 integrable. Not normalizable. And so one, that's the reason why we need to apply this technique of defining the physical inner product by just applying the delta functions to one entry in the kinematical inner product. So that's what we will discuss tomorrow. And of course, one can ask, okay, how many delta functions should we apply here if there's all h gammas? So you can imagine, I mean, first thing is that if you have, which I can't really draw here, if you have a region and you subdivide it into smaller regions, and each of this region has vanishing holonomy, then what is the holonomy around this bigger circle? It's also 0. Yeah, so which you can either by integrating or more precisely, you can really put these holonomies together to write the big holonomy in terms of the small holonomy. And so that means that basically what one needs to define is kind of smallest faces of your, for instance, spin network graph, where actually the holonomies are defined. And we need only to impose the constraints for the smallest faces. And actually that only works so nicely that we can just have smallest faces, because it's 3D gravity, which is a topological theory, because otherwise we would actually need to do a limit, and somehow one can, in principle, one can also take this, discuss this limit in 3D gravity. Just that there's not much happening there. And so actually yesterday, we finished with me telling you that you should consider what is the dual to this graph. It's this one. or usually have difficulties in drawing this thing. Okay, we will discuss that more in detail tomorrow. But if I want to draw the dual of the thing, then I didn't really define to you that that if you have an outside face, and here you have an outside face, which is outside the thing, that counts also as a face. And you should put a vertex in it. And actually, seeing this as an outside face is something which gives you a spherical topology. Surprisingly. And in fact, if you draw the dual, this is exactly the same graph as this one. Every vertex is connected to every other vertex. And here you can at least imagine that if you take a tetrahedron and look on top of it, it's what it looks like. And the outside face is the face which is on the bottom of the tetrahedron. So in fact, you can take a tetrahedral graph, and that's dual to a tetrahedron, which is a kind of one of the more simpler triangulations of the sphere. I mean, there are even more simpler triangulations of the sphere. But let's take a tetrahedron. And that's what we will do tomorrow. And then you guys can think about how many holonomies. So if you take this, for instance, as dual graph, how many holonomies do you need to put there? And holonomies, I mean holonomies which you can draw along edges of this graph. How many independent holonomies do you need to put there? Okay, so that will be tomorrow.